if there is some overriding reason, if there's some reason, like very important reason, to do it anyway, then you have to consider that. So in the case of milk products, if someone is, let's say, a pujari, or someone even at home, like a householder, is making very serious offerings, some householders are very serious, especially the women, sometimes they have very serious worship. They really take, they have a deity or something, they take it very seriously. And they really want to offer that to Krishna. And then you could argue that the cow that gave the milk that's being offered to Krishna is gaining benefit and so on. And the cow would not get that benefit if he didn't make the offering. But the reality is that many devotees nowadays, including myself, don't really make elaborate offerings. It's like, we're serving Krishna, we're hungry, and you have to offer something because you're hungry. And so you take something and you offer it. And so if our lifestyle or our devotional temperament is such that for the most part we're offering things to Krishna because we have to eat, and we're offering things we like and so on. So our real consideration is that I'm offering something because that's what I feel is good for me to eat. It's not that I'm in the mood of a serious pujari or with a deity. Then it seems to me, why would we, if it's for our own satisfaction, it's one argument someone could make, why patronize, why accept products from someone that's being murdered?
I only consider that a very reasonable argument. I prefer not to open my mouth. I just follow there. But people are, because we find, how can you stop eating?
But again, if you're making a very serious offering and your meditation is really Krishna's pleasure, you're actually meditating. I mean, Krishna the butter thief, we should remember, Krishna was a butter thief. He was just a baby. And when he got a little older, he wasn't stealing butter anymore. And so...
Stealing princesses.
What?
Stealing princesses.
Yeah, so if your meditation is really Krishna's pleasure, you're really completely focused on Krishna's pleasure, that's one thing. But if you're just hungry and you have to offer something... Yeah, then I think for our own satisfaction, we perhaps should not patronize a murderous industry. And I'm not saying that devotees, have to be vegan, obviously. It's everyone's individual choice, but that's at least one way of reasoning. Of course, if you're making no. I mean,
no, she's very small.
She's actually only about. But she's young. She can sit with us. Asking for what?
For the right.
All right. Any other question?
What specifically are you teaching at the university?
Religions of India. I'm going through the whole history of religion in India.
What books are you using?
I'm going to show you standard textbooks. Bhagavad Gita, Introduction to Hinduism, Buddhism, Indian philosophy, a book in Indian philosophy, you can see. Yes?
Do you still feel like Vaishnava or really Krishna, 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 I don't know.
The word Vaishnava? Because Vishnu, I mean, Vishnu means God.
Or maybe Vishnu Tattva, that idea.
Yeah. What do we say, Vishnu Tattva? Vishnu is just a general word name for Krishna. Since I spoke today, you know, at the temple, we live in a very unphilosophical age. I see, even because I'm teaching at probably the best university in Florida, University of Florida. You have this, I mean, I see the students; they really get enlivened with, you know, they hear stories and everything. Everyone does, so just dry philosophy, but it's not a very philosophical age, actually. It's a very unphilosophical age. Because life moves so quickly. It's become very superficial. One interesting thing, like in teaching the course, is that I realized that for most of my adult life, I've been, to some extent, misrepresenting Buddhism. And then, as like we say, that Buddhism is, you know, voidism, shunyavad. And Buddhism is diverse. Not long after the historical Buddha disappeared, within several generations, there were like 18 different Buddhist schools. They had different philosophies. There was one school called Pudgalavad that taught that we are actually eternal persons. And the Buddha himself never explicitly denied there's a self. And what's interesting is that in Buddhism, as it's actually lived as a real religion, Buddhists were very attached to their personal life. They're very concerned about their forefathers, ancestors. They're very concerned about their families. They wanted the form of Buddhism. The Buddhist world kind of split into two large divisions: the Mahayana and Hinayana. And I forget, I don't know, like 85% of the Buddhists in the world are Mahayana, who actually want to go to heaven. I mean, their goal is to go to heaven. To go to heaven and to enjoy life in heaven with their families. So it's, and the voidism, the main voidist, you could say, philosopher, Shunyavad, was Nagarjuna. Nagarjuna, and he didn't teach that everything's void. Actually, what they meant by voidism, it's interesting what he did mean. What he meant by voidism is a doctrine based on a doctrine called Pratityasamutpada, which means that, well, he translated sort of non-literally as dependent origination. The idea is that if you take a table, you call this a table, actually it's made of different parts, and you can break it into parts, and none of the parts are the table. And so there really is no such thing as a table. It didn't exist before, it won't exist in the future, it's always like in a state of change. And you can break it down into parts, and there's the color. Like, you know, the color isn't the table, and the shape isn't the table, and you put them all together, but there really isn't one permanent thing called a table. And so they accept there's really a material world. It's like in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, the material world is endlessly mutable, everything's always changing. So, because they, Nagarjuna, didn't accept the existence of an eternal soul, so he believed the material world really... Although they want to get nirvana, and apparently nirvana doesn't end, and so it's... The funny thing is that they were never actually able to work out a definition of nirvana. Because nirvana is not a positive word. Nirvana is grammatically a negative word. Nir means without. So it means without vana, whatever that is. Without the current of material existence. And so Buddha never explained, Siddhartha Gautama never explained what nirvana is. And there's never been any agreement on it. And so, you know, 2,500 years after Buddha, they're still not exactly sure what nirvana is. And there's many different ideas about it. And The emptiness of the material world, the shunyata, the emptiness of the material world is not that it doesn't exist, it's just that everything exists in a dependent, temporary way. And that's what they meant by emptiness. And the Buddhists explicitly, explicitamente, they rejected nihilism, nihilismo, the idea that nothing exists. They explicitly rejected it. So, shunyavad, like, what is shunyavad? Like, I guess it depends on who you're preaching to and what you're preaching. But in general, I think that if we speak about other religions, like Buddhism, we have to have some basic knowledge about them. Shankara is also interesting. Our presentation of Shankara is, Prabhupada quoted the famous Jagan Mithya, Brahma Satyam, Jagan Mithya. But Shankara also didn't teach that the material world doesn't exist. Actually, no one really taught that. I mean, that sort of strong nihilism that there really isn't a world here. Actually, no one really taught that. What Shankara taught is that, I mean, Shankara's philosophy and the Buddhist philosophy I find to be artificial and sort of incoherent, but what they did teach is that Shankara, that he takes this statement in the Upanishads that everything, that there's only Brahman, there's nothing, Sarvam Kalvidam Brahman, everything is Brahman. He takes this very literally in sort of an unconditional way, that everything is Brahman, and Brahman has no parts, and so therefore, when you're an illusion, you see the world as a world of variety, but when you're enlightened, you see it's only Brahman. And so where the variety goes, he doesn't really explain it. It's not a very good philosophy. When I really studied it for this course, I was thinking, oh my God, I can't believe anyone took this seriously. Because it's just, it's kind of, I think, ridiculous. It's so artificial because it's obvious. I mean, the obvious situation of the world is Veda Veda. That, yes, everything is Brahman, but there's variety.
Well, all right.
Oh my God. Mantra Mukherjee.
The Miami Emperor Major.
More control.
Yeah, from Miami. The Miami crew.
Miami crew. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Usually, we always hear that Shankara said that material creation is just subjective illusion.
Yeah. I mean, not in the sense that it's not here, but just in the sense that it appears as variety. He gave the example of a rope appearing as a snake. But of course, then Prabhupada says very brilliantly that there's a real rope and there's a real snake. But if you take that example that a rope appears as a snake, then this world, when we're an illusion, appears to have all kinds of variety. He doesn't say the world's not here. He just says it appears to have variety in a certain state of consciousness. And when you see it from a different state of consciousness, you see there's only Brahman.
But how does he put it together? Because
well, he doesn't.
Yeah.
And that's why no one really takes it seriously.
Said,
yeah, and that's why no one, I mean, very few people actually take it seriously because it doesn't make sense. And what do you do with it? It's like, okay, we're here talking, we're individuals, we're in a room, but we see it that way just because we're in an illusion or a certain state of consciousness. That's not really what we're experiencing. What we're really experiencing is that we're individual souls and we have relationships and this is really a table. And you can philosophize about it, but you can't philosophize it away. Sure, this table is temporary and the table is ultimately Brahman. Nagarjuna would say it's empty. The table is empty because there is no real table. It's just different parts and the parts are changing over time. Okay, but for practical purposes, there's really a table here. And if you need a table and you haven't got one, you really need to get a table. And you can say it's all empty, fine, but this empty table is holding everything very nicely. And this empty table is actually about the right height and the right size, and so it's a very nice empty table for my purpose. So these philosophies, they're too extreme, they're too extremist, they're too radical, in the sense of, all right, the world's illusory, yes, when we're in a higher state of consciousness, it'll look differently, it will look different to us, but still, what we're seeing now is not radically, absolutely wrong. It's just that we're basically seeing the world as it is, but we're not seeing it fully, because we're not seeing Krishna here. We're not seeing how this world is also Krishna's energy. Yes?
A non-philosophical question. Did you turn the recorder on by any chance?
Yes. Non-philosophical answer. Yes. So, well, actually I didn't. I couldn't. I was unable to do that, but Jayasita was able to do it. Because when you go to music school, they teach you how to turn on tape recorders. Another point is, now there are certain modern physicists or scientists, even some are atheists, who will say, for example, this table, if you actually look at this table from the point of view of physics, it's mostly empty space. It's just like these little electrons or protons or this ton or that ton. And it's mostly space. I mean, almost all the table is just space. However, I give the example of a weed whacker. You know what a weed whacker is? Es una cosa que usan para cortar la grama que tiene una cuerdita así que gira muy rápido. Weed es mala hierba, and whacker. Weed whacker, yeah. So, the point is that a weed whacker is only just a little piece of string or rope, you know, a thin piece of rope. But when it's turned on, it effectively creates a force field so that the speed of that little rope in relation to the speed of your hand means that, for practical purposes, there is a complete circle of energy there which will whack your little lotus hand if you touch it. So in the same way, this table, even if you say there's spaces, well, not really. Because the way the atoms and molecules function, there is effectively a force field here which is holding these objects. And there's another point. The other point is that, so it's not really just space, it's really energy, because if it was really space, this would fall through. It may be space, but the real particles in there are actually creating a force field which acts as a solid. And so it comes out to be the same thing. And another point is that the world is ultimately created to be phenomenon. In other words, let's say you go to a museum and you see a painting in a museum. And let's say you understand something about art history and you actually appreciate and understand the art. And then someone comes up to you and says, "Hi, I'm a chemist. I manufacture paint. And actually, I know it's the real painting. It's the real painting. It's just a bunch of oil paint. And I can tell you about it chemically." And the answer is no. The art, the visual art, is the real painting. And the chemistry of the oil paints is simply serving the real painting, the art. Because paintings are teleological. Telos is a Greek word for purpose. Yeah, so therefore a painting has a purpose. The reason the artist used this and that oil paint is to create a certain visual image. And so therefore when you see that visual image and when you appreciate the art, that's the real painting. And so in the same way, Krishna made the sky to be blue. So to say that, well, no, when you study atmospheric science and talk about the refraction of light in the Earth's atmosphere, that's not the real sky. Going out and looking up at the blue sky, that's the real sky. Why? because it was created teleologically. It was made as a work of art. And so when you see the blue sky, you're seeing the real sky. And so the idea that, in other words, to say that the physical reality of something, or the atomic reality, or the subatomic reality is, say, the real table, is nonsense, because it's subjecting the metaphysical to the physical. It's saying the metaphysical means that which is beyond the physical. So this table ultimately exists as an object of consciousness, and as it serves a certain purpose. So as an object of consciousness, if I feel it is solid, it was made to be solid. That's its purpose. It's made to serve the purpose of a conscious observer and a conscious user. And so therefore, as soon as you say, like, obviously there are different realities in this table. For example, when I put my hand on it or put some other object on it, it's solid. It's a solid surface. Whereas you could say from the point of view of certain types of theories in physics, it's actually wide spaces with little energies in them. So now when you say that the table as seen, let's say, from the point of view of subatomic physics, that's the real table. Now as soon as you use the word real, that adjective real is not a scientific word. It's actually a philosophical claim. Because to say that there are different aspects to an object which have different levels of reality, and that the analytic mathematical aspect of it is somehow superior to, more real, or more important than the phenomenological aspect, in other words, as an object of consciousness, is to make a philosophical claim. And so how will the scientists defend that philosophical claim? Not the science. You can talk all you want about the science. Like, say, the sky, you can talk about the refraction of light and why the sky looks blue to us and the nature of the eye as an organ and so on. But as soon as you say this perception of it is more real than that, you're making a philosophical, not a scientific claim. And the person making the claim is almost always not trained in philosophy. And on what basis will you make that philosophical claim? That this is more real than that. Again, it's like the painting in the museum. The person that actually understands art history and understands something about aesthetics and about art, is that person seeing the real painting, or just a chemist that knows how to mix oil paint? Who is seeing the real painting?
So that means that the teleological aspect is ultimately what makes things real and purposeful.
Well, it's like, for example, your shirt. Your shirt was manufactured to be a shirt. That's why you bought it. So you could say it's just cloth or this or that, but it was made with a purpose. And you chose a certain color, or your wife chose the color, whatever. And so the point is that you chose the color not because you like particular kinds of atoms that have particular spaces or a certain number of electrons or something. You chose that shirt, or you chose that dress because you like the color. So that's why you're wearing it, because it satisfies your purpose.
So that field in itself is another concept of reality, no?
Well, the table, I'm saying, like the table, it functions as a solid surface. You can say that no, according to certain kinds of physics, it's just empty spaces, but no. If it was an empty space, in any ultimate sense, it couldn't hold anything. The reason it holds things is because it effectively creates a solid force field. So if you want to say that these are widely separated particles creating a solid force field, or just say it's a solid table. It's like a rose is a rose, mm-hmm. like Shakespeare said. And so, What it is scientists just sort of trying to blow everyone's mind and say that, you know, everyone in the world is seeing things in a certain way, but we really see it better than you see it, and we're really the smart people, and you don't really know what it is, and, you know, you have to learn from us, we are the gurus. It's just a kind of, to say that that's the real picture of it is a kind of vanity. Just a kind of vanity.
What about Descartes, that he said that we don't see real substance, we just see...
Descartes?
Yeah. See, real substance, the example that he gives of the la cera, no? How do you say cera?
Wax.
The wax. That the wax changes. And said we ultimately, we don't see real substance, we just see changing qualities.
Well, that's based on...
we don't see...
Substance. Well, that's based on... Of course, sort of an Aristotle's view that the idea that there is a substance, think of the word substance, what it means literally is substantia. Mm-hmm. It means estar debajo de, isn't it? Substantia. Yes, stans is estar, like English stand, state, un estado por bajo, substantia. Yeah. So, substance, to stand beneath, substand. So the idea that there's some energy, I mean, like we only see things because they have colors. But then again, I mean, Descartes, you know, you take the wax, and you say that there's some substance which is not beneath the qualities, or that, I mean, of course, I mean, we do have an example of energy, material energy that's not perceptible, like air. Air has the quality of touch. You can feel the air on your skin, but you can't see the air. And if you see, like, say, a cloud, you're just seeing, you know, certain condensation of moisture or something. But air itself, pure air, you can't see. We also can't see space. We also can't see space. Space is actually a substance. I mean, it's an element. And the truth is... Sorry. So, the proof that space, ether, is an actual element is that you can measure it. You can measure the space between us. Even if there was a complete vacuum between us, you could still measure the space. So space is measurable, but you can't perceive it. Better turn my ring off. Anyone else have their cell phone on? Pass around a bucket of water if you put their cell phone in it. So, as far as Descartes saying that you can't, you only see quality. Well, but this is energy. I mean, that idea that there's a substance which you can't perceive, actually it's just Krishna's energy. It's just Krishna's energy. It's just, I think, according to modern science, it's just energy, right? It takes different forms. It appears in different ways.
Can we say that's the nature of the substance?
For example, you take a piece of wood, and you can see it. You can see the wood. But if you transform the wood into heat by burning it, you can't see the heat. You can feel it, but you can't see it. It's kind of technical. So, any other question? Any other somewhat less technical question?
I had another question about Shankar. You often hear people say that the end, he was saying Vajagovinda, Vajagovinda.
I don't know if it's the end or the middle or throughout. But Shankar... You know, he's called a covered Buddhist, he's called a covered Vaishnava, he's sort of a covered everything, but... Yeah, I mean, Shankar, even in the mundane academic textbooks, they say that he was actually, in a sense, a Vaishnava. Although, not. I mean, Shankar, I think the explanation that he had a mission is plausible, because otherwise, how could he possibly make these such contradictions? He's obviously very brilliant to make such contradictory statements. Another interesting, very interesting point in one of the books I read is that his followers actually were more radical than him. In terms of, it's just like Buddha. Buddha's followers were more radical than Buddha. Buddha wasn't that radical. Yeah, and we can see the same thing even in ISKCON, how some devotees are like more... Yeah, more severe than Prabhupada, whereas Prabhupada had certain flexibility and some people are inflexible. Yeah, more Catholic than the Pope is anyway.
Another question. We have this Gaudiya tradition that we give Brahmana to people who are born in our Brahmana caste. So we always say that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita according to quality and severity, and according to birth. And however, save some exception, we have seen that in the Vaishnava, even in the Vaishnava tradition, they don't give Brahmana to people who are born who are born in Brahmana.
That's a Hindu custom. It's not necessarily a... First of all, there is no... I mean, certain things in Vedic culture are universal. Many things change over time. So it changes in different historical periods under different circumstances. The idea that there's one way of doing things that's always been the same way is absurd if you look at the history. So when you say Vaishnavas don't give, when? What Vaishnavas? What period in history? What part of India?
To my knowledge, either Ramanuja or Madhya, they didn't give Brahmana to everybody who was...
Well, it was a different situation. Because the social system was in place. There were many good... First of all, there were many good Brahmins, and they became Vaishnavas. Plus, the social system may have been so conservative that it was impossible to do that. People would have objected too much. Mm-hmm. So different teachers do what they can based on the situation they find themselves in. It's like you go to a school, if you're teaching a school, and people say, well, why didn't you just talk about Krishna? Because you can't do that. So we all have limitations. But Krishna stating the principle. Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita that people are placed in different varnas by their qualities, by their nature. That's what Krishna says. If at a particular time in history a society did or did not follow that is irrelevant. That's the principle. That's the principle. So, and it's practical. We see actually in the older Vedic literature you find there was more flexibility. There's a famous story of Satyakama. Satyakama means truth lover. You know, he was a Brahmin, well not a Brahmin boy, his mother was very low class. His mother was basically like a prostitute. And so he wanted to study the Vedas, and it's like just nowadays, if you want to study in a college, fill out the form, first question is last name. So, it's always the first question, Apeyu. It was the first question back in Vedic culture also. So, he went to this guru and he just told the truth. My mother was Boko Sweta.
21 centuries.
So the guru said, well, you're so honest, that means you're a Brahmin. His mother was a prostitute. He was accepted and became a famous Vedic sage. So Hindu custom may or may not be relevant to us. It depends.
Does that mean we use it as a convenience?
A Krishna's convenience. Yeah, Prabhupada had to reestablish Varnasha, I mean the Varna system. The system has basically collapsed. What you see in India is to some extent, is an outer shell. Because when you have people receiving Varna designations for thousands of years without any consideration of their actual qualification. Si se dice que el hijo del médico es un médico sin estudiar. If you say the child of a doctor is automatically a doctor without any study, then you're going to get an extremely corrupt and useless, dysfunctional
system.
Yes, exactly. So thousands of years of sort of blind hereditary casteism has created a real problem. Prabhupada had to recreate it. The only way he recreated it is to say, okay, who's ever qualified, whoever can do the job, come and try. And many people tried and couldn't do it. And it would be interesting to see, this has not been studied, it would actually be interesting to see, even within ISKCON, to what extent those devotees were able to successfully continue as Brahmins. In other words, they not only got initiation, but they're actually able to continue following the principles and continue to do some kind of occupation which is more or less brahminical, like teaching or worship or something. It'd be interesting to see, even in our countries, if there's any correspondence between people's backgrounds, the family they come from, and at what level they're able to function. I mean, obviously, it's not strictly hereditary, we know that. Because we know that in high families, you can get a low child, and in low families, you can get a high child. I mean, everyone knows that. It's just common sense. You can see it everywhere. But then again, at the same time, you find that, for example, in a college town, in a small university town, where a lot of the children are coming from educated parents, the level in the schools tends to be higher. Because there is something like genetic transmission, but it's not everything. And so it's a combination, nature and nurture. It's a combination. So previously, and actually Europe had a hereditary caste system for many hundreds and hundreds of years. Europe is called the feudal system, So Europe, you know, they talk about India. Europe had a hereditary caste system as much as India. And it was ended by the Industrial Revolution. That's another whole topic. How the Varna system actually assumes an agrarian economy, a land-based economy. And the reason we can't reestablish Varna system now is just because, Karl Marx actually explained that. Because the economic system determines the social and political relationships. And the Varna system is based on an agricultural economy. And we could talk all night about types of political and social realities that come out of a land-based economy and the result of an industrial revolution, urbanization, and so on and so forth. How it completely transforms the sociology of society, things like, you know, extended family becomes a nuclear family, and split the atom, so you get divorced families, you know, atomic families, and they split the atom, and then you get even less than that. And so, I mean, actually, I was thinking about that. When you have, I mean, imagine there's a like say whoever you are, there's a natural pressure that you feel from your parents. I mean, if you have mother and father and they have certain desires for you, even though you may not follow, but you feel it. You feel it. And so imagine, what if it's not just a mother and father? What if it's like a whole community, like a whole little town of relatives, aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, an extended family, and land-based economies favor extended families, because when you live on a farm, the more people you have, the better. Because there's always work. There's plenty of food, and there's always work to do. When you live in a city, the more people in the family, the more expensive it is. So actually, it's economically favorable to have large families on a farm, and it's economically unfavorable to have large families in a city. And so with the urbanization, industrial revolution, and all that, it becomes economically impractical, disadvantageous to have a large family. Either to have many children or to live with your aunts and uncles, because it's just... You see that, for example, if you study the sociology of immigration, what you find is that when The group people first immigrate to a new country, they tend to stick together. They live very austerely, you know, they work very hard and send their children to college. And then what you find is, once they've done that, in the next generation, they don't all live together. They all buy their own houses. And so, but when you live in the land, and you have an extended family, and you live in a village where you know everyone, and everyone knows you, and half people in the village are related to you, at least, and you have this massive social pressure. And so it naturally makes things more conservative, whereas cities are more anonymous. And so you can study anywhere in the world, as you know, Venezuela or Florida or Germany. You can study anywhere in the world, and you'll find that people who live out in the country are more conservative. I mean, various reasons. People who live in cities are more cosmopolitan. And so, isn't it? I mean, anywhere in the world, there's exceptions. There's like little liberal cities or some conservative neighborhoods. I mean, in big cities. But in general, you find that. I mean, for various reasons. Number one, because people in small towns see nature, and therefore they have some common sense. People in cities are alienated from nature and tend to have no common sense. But also because, like, if you live in a city, especially, let's say, I'd say Gainesville, a college town, or say Miami, where you see people from many different countries. And so you have contact with, you meet good people from many parts of the world, coming from all kinds of cultures. And therefore, in your own mind, it relativizes your culture. You understand that my culture is just my culture. Whereas if you live in a place where everyone is the same, then you tend to think that there's no other way. It becomes more conservative, more simple. Anyway, there's so much you could say about it. You can go into the whole thing, but as far as the Varna system, it depends upon a certain economic and social reality, which doesn't exist anymore.
Except appear that this understanding is simple, not that people should be considered Brahmana or whatever according to qualities and so on. We understand it. But
there's tremendous conservatism.
Yeah, but I mean,
if a man has a business, he wants to leave the business to his children, not to someone else. Isn't it? Parents, they want to leave their patrimonio, they want to leave whatever they have to their own children. So if someone's a Brahmin, and a Brahmin's a status, it's a certain social status, and you're living in a conservative, simple society, naturally you want to leave that to your children. Because your culture is Brahminical culture, and so if your child is not a Brahmin, the child won't even have the same culture as you in some ways. And that's what you can leave. Like if you're a king, because in capitalism, you have capital, so you can leave capital to your children. But in a conservative society, you have land. Let's say in an agrarian society, you own a farm. And so the farm is useless unless you work the farm. Or a business is useless unless you work the business. So, so naturally parents, they want to leave. Because in those days, to be a kshatriya or vaishya or brahmin is not simply a job. It's a culture. It's a whole culture. It's a whole way of life, which is different from other varnas. And so parents naturally want their children to continue the family traditions. You have family traditions. They have to be continued. That was Arjuna's concern. So you have to be able to feel what it's like to be in a pre-industrial society. It's very different. It feels very different. Tremendous conservatism.
Even though India had so many great philosophers during thousands of years, how come they didn't preaching that sense? Come on.
They didn't what?
They accepted that kind of customs. They didn't revolt against
it. Why aren't the professors at the University of Florida revolting against the fact that most young people in Florida can't go to the University of Florida? In fact, most professors prefer to teach in a very prestigious university that has a low acceptance rate. For example, if you go to an Ivy League school, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, probably they accept about maybe, 10, 11, 12% of their applicants. So the fact that they reject most of the people who want to go there is considered to be a plus. I mean, and that makes it prestigious. Why aren't the professors at Harvard and Yale protesting that most people can't go there? Actually, when I was at Harvard, I noticed that a couple times I just walked into the admission office. I was just curious, like, okay, what's the Harvard admissions office? And I sort of read some of the literature, I was curious. And what I noticed is that they really strongly encourage everyone to apply to Harvard. They need large numbers of unqualified applicants because it would be an absolute disaster for Harvard if, let's say, they accepted 30% of the applicants. It would ruin everything. So they need large numbers of people to apply so they can reject them and have a very prestigious low acceptance rate. So you're really doing a service to these great schools by applying and being rejected. They need you to do that. And also, another thing, if you look at European culture, Indian culture, in pre-industrial civilization, people live in the country, they don't have, there's not the concept of public higher education. And therefore, there's a very significant cultural difference between high and low class people. If you look at Europe before the Industrial Revolution, people speak almost different languages. I mean, the high class people would speak Latin. In Europe, the low class people, no one can understand them. They only understand each other. And so culturally, there's a tremendous difference between classes. And therefore, lower classes, perhaps because of lack of opportunity, really run qualified. So it seemed natural, everyone in their place. So, another question? Anyway, in this age, just chanting Hare Krishna, that's the real point. That's what we'll stop here with a big day tomorrow.